working strangely.
Okay, so our next presenters are Gwendolyn Kislov from University of Oregon and Hermann Serin from Firebird Foundation. And the presentation is Developing Bhutan Orthographies for Endangered Languages of Bhutan.
Thank you. So I should just say right up front that this is definitely work that has been done between me and Karma in collaboration right from the beginning. So it's a co-authored paper. However, I'm going to do all the talking, but it's Karma's job to correct me if I make a mistake, especially if when we get to the details of the Uchin script, which are going to be complicated. Of course, we'll be able to help answer questions at the end. We're talking about developing Uchin orthographies for the languages of Bhutan, but I'm primarily going to be illustrating the process that we've used to develop an orthography for Kurtip, which is one of the languages of Bhutan. And at the end of the process, the government's asked us to make the orthography applicable to all of Bhutan's endangered languages, so when we've made the end decisions, we're trying to keep this in mind. So the process in Kurtip is something that we think can work throughout the country. Okay, so here's an outline of our talk. I'm going to start a little bit with an introduction on Kurtip and literacy in Bhutan. I'll talk about the midwife approach. This is a term I think that is attributed to Chris Stenzel at Infield 2008. I'll illustrate the midwife approach in Kurtip. Basically, it's orthography development as a process. Some of the parts of the process have been questions about what to represent and how to represent complex, the rest of the sentence here is missing, but it's complex onsets. And then tone is in there as well. And then we've had discussions with the local community, the community abroad, local Buddhist scholars, teachers. Community in Bhutan really means a lot of different things. And you'll see some of the different people I've had to interact with. Testing with speakers, holding workshops, and then continuing on into the future as the midwife approach continues. Okay, so about Kurtip. Kurtip is a previously undescribed Tibeto-Burman language of Bhutan. My dissertation is the first grammatical description, so there was no work, almost no work before, just a little bit on the phonology, no orthography development at all. In fact, really no orthography development in the country at all, with the exception of what was used for the national script and some formal, which is used for the national language, and then some formal romanization that is not really used. Kurtip has about 15,000 speakers. They're in northeastern Bhutan. We'll see a map in a second. There are no monolingual speakers, at least not that I have met in the time I've spent there since 2006. Most of the speakers are also fluent in Dzongkha, which is the national language. They also speak Tsongkhla, which is a lingua franca of eastern Bhutan. That's not written, but they're also often fluent in Nepali and Hindi, which are written, although most speakers aren't literate in those languages. They are literate in English, which a lot of them speak, and they're also literate in Dzongkha. So in developing the orthography, we have to keep these two literacies in mind because they're going to be coming from one of those points of view into the language that into their own language. So here is where Kurtip's spoken. Kurtip is spoken. If you're not familiar with Bhutan, probably most people in this audience are, but if you're not, this is in the Himalayas, sandwiched between India in the south and Tibet in the north, and then Kurtip is that little blob on the northeastern part of the country. The national language Dzongkha, which I mentioned, is spoken by this grayer blob in the western part of the country. This is where it's spoken as a native language, but as a national language, people throughout the language communities are fluent in Dzongkha as well. So that's the Kurta background and the literacy background in Bhutan. Now let me say something a little bit about the midwife approach. As I said, I think this is a term that goes back to Chris Stenzel in 2008. She and Karen Rice co-taught a workshop on orthography development. In 2010, Karen Rice and I co-taught the workshop on orthography development. It turned out I'd been using the same philosophy. I hadn't come across the term midwife approach, but I absolutely loved it. So the three of us, after Infield, worked together to put a giant PowerPoint that kind of combined the two workshops, and that's what the reference is here. And if you have a handout, the reference for that is on the bottom of the handout, the last page. So it's just a PowerPoint. you can download from the Infield website. I wasn't really sure how to cite that, so that's the best I got there. The overall idea of the midwife approach is to view orthography development as a process that's based on exchange and integration of knowledge and experiences of a linguist and a language community. And again, in our case, the language community is not just speakers, it's the Bhutanese government and a broader community. The community, we like to be an active participant sharing responsibility for the final outcome of the orthography. Our role as linguists has been a facilitator, trying to guide the practice. Maybe in our case in Bhutan, we're doing a little bit more guidance than other people have, but that's just been the nature of doing these things in Bhutan. Decisions in Bhutan generally come from the top down. That's the way people are used to doing things. You can't expect them to do things differently because you're there. So they're expecting things to come from the top down. So we're trying to help from the top getting down. A little bit about government policies. So linguistic research in Bhutan is necessarily collaborative with the government, so you can't go and do research unless you're going to talk to the government about what you're going to do. And orthography development has been that way. The government required us to have a Roman and Uchin-based orthography. The Roman orthography was pretty easy, so we're not going to talk about that. The Uchin one, which is what Tibetan-like, has been pretty complicated, so that's the focus of this talk. For those of you who aren't familiar, Uchin is the Tibetan-based orthography that was derived from Brahmi, probably, people say, around 632 AD. And you have an example here on the slide of what it looks like in Tibetan. There are actually two versions of Uchin. There's Tsui, which is on the top. This is the formal version that you see in traditional Buddhist texts. Monks will carve out these wood blocks using a knife and carefully make these Buddhist texts that way. Or they'll use calligraphy with the bamboo, and it's all very precise and difficult to do. Children don't like it. It's hard work. There's a second version, luckily, of Uchin called Joey. That's the one you see on the bottom. And this is a script that is said to have been originated in Bhutan. So it's this Uchin, the top Tsui one, is also used in Tibet and other places where people have Tibetan Buddhist texts. But the Joey script is unique to Bhutan. And also, it's like a cursive. It's easier for children to write. That's what they teach in the schools. And nowadays, children's books and even moving up to young adults' books and novels are being written in Joey. So we had to decide, first of all, which one of these to use. And it was an easy choice, obviously, to go with the Joey indigenous one, and easy to write. A nice thing about this, too, is that we're slightly removed from Buddhism in this case. If we went with the upper one, we're really attached to Buddhist texts, and it gets really hard to represent things. But now we're a little less attached to Buddhism going with this Joey. We had to make some decisions about linguistic factors, of course. Deep versus shallow representation. There's some pretty simple and predictable allomorphy on case enclitics and verbal suffixes. For example, we have a perfective suffix that alternates pa, wa, and sa. There was consensus among the community members to represent the allomorphy in all examples. This was just straightforward and an easy decision. We also had to decide how much to represent. So there's minimal tone and vowel length contrast in the language. Tone is contrastive following sonorant consonants, and vowel length is contrastive in open syllables. It's not all that salient, but there are, you know, a handful of minimal pairs. And because of this, the speakers felt that it was important to represent it. And the tone, even though it's, you know, there aren't that many minimal pairs, the difference is quite salient. You're sometimes dealing with 30 hertz difference between high and low tone, so it was important to represent this to the speech community. So now we're having to represent this with Uchin, so let me give you an introduction to the Uchin syllable. This is a template of it. So as I said, this was what was used to represent classical Tibetan about 1,400 years ago. We have a root consonant, we call it, represented by R here. There are 30 different consonants that can go in this position. if we look at C1, C2, and C4, these can be combined with the R to make a complex onset. C1 can fit five different consonants can go in there. So you have to look at my notes for this because it's too complicated to keep in mind. And then C2, there are three particular consonants that can go in there. And these ones would be pronounced before the R. The C4 is for a consonant that's pronounced after the R, again, still as a complex onset. So we're dealing with really complex syllables in classical Tibetan. A vowel is represented above or below this mess. If it's an U vowel, it goes below. If it's an E, A, or O, it goes above. And if it's an A vowel, it's unmarked, and then you know the lack of marking means it's an A vowel. The C3 would be for a simple coda. And in the C3, there are 10 possible codas that could go in there. If you have a complex coda, you put something in C5, and that's either an S or a D in classical Tibetan, although the D was really rarely used. So let me give you an example of a word to illustrate this. So this is the classical Tibetan word beskrup, which meant procure or achieve, I think. So here we have, in the R position, we have a G. There are two consonants before that in the complex, as the complex onset, ba and sa. Actually, you know, nobody really knows how classical Tibetan was pronounced, but I think people speculate that there was probably an epenthetic schwa between the ba and the other consonants here. So something like beskrup. Nonetheless, this is how it's represented. And then the consonant following the root is an R, as you can see there. Here, this R isn't the normal R symbol that would go in the root category. In this slot, the C4 slot here, you have to use a special variation. Maybe you call it like a half letter. So this is actually a half R in this case. And then you see the U underneath, and then the B and the S afterwards for the complex coda. So here is how, this is a syllable. Every syllable is represented this way, and this is an example of the classical Tibetan word beskrup. This is the classical Tibetan system, which is used to represent Dzongka, but we have to keep in mind that this system was created when classical Tibetan was spoken, and we have to have some knowledge of classical Tibetan phonology. So we had classical Tibetan had about 28 consonants contrasting at labial, dental, palatal, and velar places of articulation. Obviously, there were complex onsets. There were five vowels, and there was no tone. Okay, 1,400 years later, we're still writing words using the same system, but there has been lots and lots of phonological change. For example, we have a new series of retroflex consonants. We have three new vowels. We have high and low tone register in some dialects, including Dzongka. We have a contrast between level and falling tonal contours as well. We have changes in voicing aspiration, and we have simplified onsets, and we have diphthongs. So the language has changed considerably, but the writing system has remained the same. Basically, when you're reading Dzongka, you are inferring the changes that have been made from classical Tibetan into Dzongka. This is an incredibly difficult system for Dzongka speakers to learn. This is one of the hardest subjects in school. And in Bhutan, there's no other way to represent these languages using Uchin. You've got to stick with this classical Tibetan model. That's what people do. And there's been no other orthography development using this system at all in Bhutan until now. So just to go back to this example again, a student comes across this word in a text, and they are taught to pronounce this word as du, getting rid of all the complex onsets. There's a different tone there, and then the second coda is lost. So this is actually a relatively simple example. There are many more examples which are even more difficult to read. It's basically like learning Chinese. You just really have to memorize the way every word is written. So this is a system we have to use for Kurtip. Here's an aspect of Kurtip phonology which has been a little complicated to deal with. There are complex onsets in Kurtip. We have pra, pla, mra, mya, qua, things like this. And we immediately run into problems. If in classical Tibetan we had the word bra, we would represent it like this, with a pa root and then a half bra in that position underneath, and it would have been pronounced bra. But if you show this word to anyone who's educated in Dzongkha, they'll say da, because that's the system they've learned to infer the change to a retroflex stop, and that's how they're going to pronounce it. So what do we do about that? Here's one idea we had, which is to use the symbols as if they were Roman, you know, make a linear path. So you have ba, ra, but the problem we ran into immediately was, okay, this works for but what do we do about vowels that aren't because we don't have a separate symbol for the other vowels. We have to use these diacritics. So one idea we had was to mark the vowel on the root like you normally would. I thought this looked nice. This could be ble, which is the number 4. However, speakers would read this as le in Dzongkha or Tibetan. They get rid of the ba and they give a high tone on the following vowel. That's how you would read this in Dzongkha and Tibetan. So let's try again. Another idea was to mark the vowel on both this prefix position and the root. So actually, this would looks like ble, but actually people pronounced it as ble, so that was good. But this is not, this just didn't look good to people, and it doesn't follow the conventions that we're dealing with. So no good for either of those. Okay, so what do we do? All right, we finally had this idea. Let's organize a workshop. We did this in January 2009. We had Scott Delancey in the area. We called him up. He was the eminent Tibeto-Burmanist. He was a Tibetologist. He was, people were going to want to come and listen to him. So we organized a workshop where he gave a talk about classical Tibetan, what it meant, the difference between orthography and phonology, how phonology and orthography were matched in classical Tibetan, and how the sound changes have happened and that mismatch has taken place since then. And then I gave a talk about the problems we were dealing with, and you know, here are some of the things we've tried. This isn't working. How can we come together and solve this problem? In our audience, we had religious leaders, including the principal for a religious school. We had newspaper editors, high school students, government ministers. There was a minister of labor and agriculture. We had local linguists and academics, of course, and then we had a font developer who turned out to be an amazing gift for us. So here's just a few pictures from the workshop. I guess they don't come out very well here, but I think that's okay. There's Scott and me in the front, and then some of our audience members here. And finally, after all this discussion, we came up with a solution. For the complex onsets, we decided instead of using a half consonant underneath, we can use a full one. So here's how it looks for qua, qua, gua, pra, and so on. Underneath all of these, we have the full version of the consonant instead of the half one. This was great for several reasons. First of all, it's based on existing conventions that were established in Tibetan. People didn't know about these generally because they were in Tibetan texts like from 1200s used to represent Mongolian, but it was there. There was some history. This shouldn't affect Dzongkha transference issues because students studying Dzongkha had never seen this before, so they're not going to take this in Purtip and try to pronounce it like Dzongkha. It looks nice. It follows the conventions, as I said, and the Purtip speakers that we've been testing this with find it intuitive and easy to read. So moving forward with that, the first immediate problem, of course, was that there was not a computer font that did this. However, Chris Finn is the font developer for the Dzongkha Development Commission. He was in the audience, and he was very happy to adapt the fonts that he had been working on to accommodate the new accommodations. And since, as I said, we were in the beginning of this, and the Bhutanese government was saying, okay, we want this for all the languages, we brainstormed, you know, got all the phonology in our minds as best we could from the different languages, and he's putting it all together to make sure we can get all these different contrasts. I also mentioned tone, so he found a system to mark tone. That's here on the top row. There's a little tick going above that's marking high tone. And another great thing about this is this was a system apparently used, I'm saying apparently because I don't know the text, but a scholar told me, it was used to mark accent in Sanskritic words. So it's again something that's been used in the past and we can incorporate it in for the future. And then below is what the complex onsets look like. So the first one here, this is, they read it as kayata. It's a ka with a half ya underneath, which in Tibetan would have been kya, but anyone who speak, who reads dzongka today pronounces it as cha. So to get kya, we have the second one here, which is a ka and then underneath a full ya. Over on the next one, we have karata, which is a ka with a half ra underneath. Again, in classical Tibetan, this would have been pronounced kra, we speculate anyway, but it's changed to retroflex, da, in modern-day dzongka. So that's what we couldn't do. But moving again one more over, we have a ka with a full ra underneath, and this is how we can represent something like kra. So we've been able to solve the problems with this. This is the Tsui font, as you can see, the fancy Buddhist one. The Joey one, I'm told, is supposed to be finished next month, and when we go back to Bhutan, hopefully it's going to be there waiting for us. So just a quick summary here. Kirtip speakers preferred a shallow and faithful orthography, both for Roman and Uchin-based. With regard to the Uchin one, it was easy to pick the Joey version. It was an indigenous script. It was easy to use and not tied so much to Buddhism. The main problem we had was using the Tibetan-like script, because the reading rules from classical Tibetan to Dzogchen that every educated person was familiar with didn't let us deal with Kirtip phonology at all. So after several years and several attempts, we held a workshop that brought enough people together with all the failed attempts in place, and we were able to come up with a solution. And then the font developer, Chris Finn, I just can't say enough good things about him. He's really been crucial key in making this possible. Just to tie back to the midwife approach, so this is a process that we're dealing with, that we're going through. I shouldn't say dealing with, because it's actually really fun, I think. The next step is we're working on a dictionary, Kirtip English Dzongka Dictionary, that hopefully will come out later this year or early next year, and we'll have the Joey font for the first time in there, just see what happens. And then, as I said, we're continuing on with fonts for the rest of Bhutan's languages. We'll see where we go from there. So, thank you.
We are on time this time.